test. 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, person.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to express my appreciation, first of all, for your coming and for your patience in our delay of this matter from the announced hour of 3 o'clock. I think I'm being fair to both you and to myself when I say that usually our press conferences are on the minute, but we were a little hung up today. I think probably, like the Senate, we're in a bit of a tizzy ourselves. Before we get into the matter, I would like to say, on behalf of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and the organizations that comprise it, express our regret over the death of Senator Richard Neuberger of Oregon, who during his time in the Senate and prior thereto as a private citizen was a supporter of the civil rights cause and gave it his talent and skill as a senator, and wrote in behalf of equality and decency for all Americans in his private capacity as a newspaperman before he became a senator. I'm sure all of us regret his passing. And now I'd like to say that the extraordinary situation that we felt probably warranted this meeting this afternoon is that we find the men of goodwill in both parties of the Senate forced into a position of fighting their own leadership in order to secure a cloture vote and to halt a filibuster. This is an extraordinary situation where neither the majority leader, Mr. Lyndon Johnson, nor the minority leader, Mr. Everett McKinley Dirksen, is supporting the move for cloture to shut off debate, despite the fact that the Senate has have been considering this question since February 15. Now, when a petition for cloture is offered, it has drawn the opposition of the leadership. The opposition to the Douglas-Javits petition means that the people in favor of cloture are being fought by the leadership solely because, this we believe, solely because cloture at this time would result in a strong civil rights bill. In other words, we interpret the leadership's position to be one of opposition to a strong bill and one in favor of a weak bill, as weak a bill as possible. Now, this is set forth here in this little statement that the filibuster has been sound and fury, signifying nothing. Because it's an attempt to fool the public into accepting a bill which is not even a shadow of the original bipartisan draft, that is the Douglas-Seller-Javits bill, S-810, introduced in January 1959. And it's a chopped-down version of the Republican bill which is offered by them in January 1959. Now, Mr. Dirksen, the minority leader, offered the administration package, and it was called, at the time of its introduction, a moderate bill. no less an apostle and authority on moderation than the President of the United States, characterized it as a moderate bill. However, this one, so characterized by President Eisenhower and by Mr. Dirksen, was an emasculated version of the proposals originally made by the Eisenhower administration in 1957. As a matter of fact, it goes back beyond that. These were the basic ingredients of the Republican Party platform at the Republican National Convention in San Francisco in 1956. Essentially these proposals. But as I say, having been offered in 56 and 57, they were chopped down in 59, and now here in January of 1960, Mr. Dirksen offers a further chopping down. Today, incredibly, Mr. Dirksen has announced that he is willing to cut out still more sections of this bill in order to secure cloture, and then to submit what might be called the triple chop version to the Senate for further butchery. And just prior to the calling of this press conference, the word has come that Mr. Dirksen is toying with still another idea, that of offering sections of the bill independently, separately, so that they can be handled in even more expeditious fashion on the floor, merely by motions to table, which would entail appeals to the chair and so forth and so on, and which would not permit debate, naturally. This means that the bill can, instead of being offered as a package under a cloture vote, would be just taken apart in little pieces on the floor, and would be handled in that fashion. Now, Senator Lyndon B. Johnson, the man who gets things done and who sees that legislation gets through the Senate, is seeking also the minimum civil rights bill as a price for securing cloture and a chance for the Senate to vote. Senator Johnson, of course, was the architect of the filibuster rule in January 1959. It was a modified rule, modified from 100 to 99, let's say, or from two-thirds of those in the Senate to two-thirds of those present and voting, which amounts to a difference in some instances of only one senator in some circumstances. So Senator Johnson here wants to prove that his cloture rule will work, and he wants to prove that he can pass a civil rights bill. But both Senator Johnson and Senator Dirksen declare that what was once a moderate administration bill is now too drastic, and that cloture cannot be secured unless the senators are assured that the Dirksen bill will be cut down to practically nothing. Thus, we see the real leader in the Senate, the man who is getting things done, is not Senator Johnson or Senator Dirksen, but Senator Russell, because this bill is being tailored to the specifications of the bloc which is headed by Senator Russell. It's been apparent to us for some time that the so-called filibuster to the death business going on in the Senate was just a farce. Nobody's fighting to the death over there. Everything's all arranged. There's goodwill on both sides. Nobody's being worn out except those civil rights senators who were annoyed by quorum calls early in the morning, and they even, I'm told, have some agreement on the hours when quorum calls will not be made. For example, I think the dinner hour is being excluded from 6 to 9 so that senators can be sure of going out and having a leisurely dinner. All these are are small truces arranged across the trenches, as it were, with the troops not hating anybody and not shooting at anybody in particular, except the civil rights forces and an effective bill. This is the only person that gets in the way of the bullet. But Senator Johnson is not shooting at Senator Russell, and Senator Dirksen certainly is not shooting at Senator Russell, although it might be expected that he would be doing so. And Senator Russell is not necessarily shooting at Senator Johnson. He's going through the motions. This is an arranged and understood spectacle as far as we're concerned. The Senate leadership is not fighting a filibuster in order to pass a strong civil rights bill. It's staging a wrestling match with all the usual grunts and groans inserted at the appropriate times. Now, the present farce will not meet the demand for a meaningful civil rights bill and will not enhance the image of the Senate leaders and will not enable either political party to claim credit for advancing the civil rights cause. There are a lot of other aspects to this matter. There's the whole business of the situation in the House. There is the fast footwork around second base in the Senate, with the possibility they may stall matters and wait for a House bill to come over. And this means that a House version has to be a strong bill, or it'll be of no consequence at all. There is some substance for the belief that not only is the Senate leadership in cahoots on this bill, but that there is a strong liaison with the House leadership to see that an emasculated version comes out. Nobody's mad at anybody over there, and everybody has his eye on July conventions and the November elections, and Mr. Johnson has his own particular ambitions, which he has not as yet disclosed. And the only persons we can be sure of over there are Senator Russell and his bloc. They don't want any kind of civil rights bill, good, bad, or indifferent, weak, strong, or middle. They want to keep the Negro citizens in the South in precisely the same position they're in. And they want to keep the federal government from interfering with the position that they now hold them in. There is some indication in the sit-down strikes by the Negro college students and in the widespread protests in the South that Senator Russell may have miscalculated the situation, and that the motions they're going through on Capitol Hill have no real relationship to the people out there in the states. It may be, and it could be, that regardless of what is done here, the real determination of the Negro civil rights will come in action by Negro citizens themselves, who are frustrated and outraged by the way in which their citizenship status has been handled. They regard the talk fest on Capitol Hill as a ping-pong game of parliamentary technicalities, which has no real relation to the situation that they face daily on the home front, you might say, the Talmadge front, the Stennis and Eastland front, the East Texas front, the South Carolina front, and Senator Holland and Senator Spessard's sun-splashed front of Florida. We want a strong bill, more than a voting bill, and we want a better provision for voting protection than now appears in some of the versions. We want the provision for protection and punishment of bombers. We want the records preserved for registration, voter registration records preserved. We believe that it's 6 years late for the Senate and the Congress of the United States to affirm support of the Supreme Court decision of 1954 and to offer the facilities of the federal government for to localities that wish to comply with that. We don't see why the Congress should go around with its head in the sand saying that the Supreme Court decision was never rendered, that there is no such thing as school desegregation problem. And we believe that Part 3 language, which was dropped from the 1957 bill, is merely language which gives the federal government the authority to defend and implement its own constitution with respect to its own citizens. And to characterize this as drastic or as an innovation or as radical simply means that those who oppose it, and these include Senator Russell, Senator Dirksen, who didn't even offer it in the administration version, and Senator Johnson, who has announced that he's opposed to it, it places these gentlemen and their groups in the position of saying that the United States government should not defend its Constitution, should not authorize the Attorney General to do this, but that if a citizen happens to get in trouble about his constitutional rights, he can try to do something about it himself. If he's successful, all right, and if he isn't successful, it's too bad. But his government will do nothing to help him. That is the reason we believe Part 3 is essential to a strong civil rights bill.
Do you think, Mr. Wilkins,
yes,
that
ma'am,
the Negro vote will be affected by a weak or strong bill and say that their the vote for the presidency will be strongly affected on how this debate goes?
Well, it's if you say you can't assume that there is a Negro vote as such that's motivated strictly and completely on a racial basis. But I would say that the wherever there is a highly emotional issue based upon race, close enough to the election, and this goes for all American citizens because they all have short memories, that it will affect some part of the Negro electorate. They are influenced by other factors, and Negro farmers are interested in the farm problem, and Negro real estate dealers are interested in real estate and taxes and bonds and stocks, and Negro landlords are interested in rent control, and Negro trade unionists are interested in labor legislation and minimum wage laws and that sort of thing. So the Negroes have a diversity of interests. But if a highly emotional racial issue evolves, it will affect the way they vote. And I believe that the ignoring of the civil rights issue by the present Congress, and that's what they're doing, they're just kicking it around, I believe that the sit-ins of the Negro students and the quick way in which the adults have rallied to their defense means that there is a strong feeling in the Negro community about civil rights and that it could easily affect the people they vote for next November. For example, I don't think a man who has to carry on his back the Poplarville lynching in Mississippi, and who has to carry on his back the gutter language of Senator Eastland in characterizing the Supreme Court decision, and who has to carry on his back the wholesale arrests of Negro students whose only crime is sitting down on a lunch counter stool, or who has to carry on his back the arrests of people by policemen with police dogs, and the fines and the expelling of Negro students for protesting segregation. A man who comes from a region that produces these phenomena has a lot to carry on his back, to say nothing of what happened in Houston, Texas, the day before yesterday, when a man was picked up on the street at random and taken out and had the KKK carved on his stomach. Now, I would think it's expecting a very great deal to say that Negro voters would ignore those incidents in considering the chances of a man for the presidency. No man running under that kind of handicap could hope to enlist the enthusiastic support of Negroes, even the reluctant support of some of them, although he might get a few clubhouse boys, let's say. If the Republicans keep on pussyfooting around on this, it might affect the evaluation of their candidate.
Except he's able to stay clear of the fight.
Well, I don't know how clear the candidate is staying of the fight. The Republican leadership in the Congress, which is tossing around this bill, certainly is not proceeding, let us say, wholly on its own and without any consultation with the Republican candidate whom we assume will be the Republican candidate for the presidency next year.
Do you think a more affirmative stand on the part of the president would make for a stronger bill?
I think so. I think the president, we have the spectacle here of the president's own party divided. They talk about the Democrats being divided. Here's the Republican leadership is opposing cloture. The Republican leadership in the Senate is saying, we will weaken the bill. We'll take out this section, we'll take out that section. The Republican leadership is saying, we can't get cloture if the bill contains such and such sections. This is not the Democratic leadership saying that, although it is saying the same thing, but this is the president's own party saying this.
Why are they saying that?
They're saying it because they don't intend, if they can help it, to pass a strong bill. They want a weak bill.
What do you think the possibilities are of getting cloture tomorrow?
I don't know what the possibilities are. They started with some 30-odd. I would say that it will be a very tight fight to get cloture tomorrow.
Is the education provisions of the administration bill satisfactory to you?
You mean the support of the Supreme Court?
Yes, and also the other section.
Providing technical assistance, technical assistance and grants and aid?
Yes.
Well, this is desirable, highly desirable. I would say that our first choice, of course, would be the original draft of S-810.
The original
Douglas Seller Javits bill, but the administration draft at least recognizes that the Supreme Court has spoken, and it does recognize that and authorize the federal government to take a hand in implementing the decision of its own court. And to that degree, of course, it's desirable and acceptable, although it isn't maximum.
Did you want to comment on this telegram from Meany that has been released here?
Well, in the matter of cloture, I just wanted to say that our leadership conference here is composed of many organizations, and one of the hardest working components in the conference has been the AFL-CIO. They have backed every step on the civil rights bill, and the latest has been Mr. Meany's telegram to senators urging them to vote for cloture. It's a strong telegram, but in keeping with Mr. Meany's own personal convictions on this matter, And certainly, in keeping with his very strong statement to the Democratic National Convention in 1956, to the Platform Committee. But Mr. Meany urges all senators to vote for this. And this is valuable aid and support from the president of the AFL-CIO.
Approximately how many delegates are there at the conference this time, and what states are represented?
There's six states represented, seven states, I'm sorry. California, Kansas, Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa,
Maryland.
And Maryland and Delaware. They're seeing their congressmen and senators today.
That's California, Kansas.
California, Kansas, Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, Maryland, Delaware.
Do you split them up like that?
Yes, last time we had Connecticut, Pennsylvania, divided up. And the time before that, we had seven more states. We've had a total of some 20 states in, delegations from some 20 states.
This was not knowingly timed for the cloture thing. It was set in advance.
That's true. Yeah, we didn't bring them in just for cloture, because the cloture was only decided upon yesterday. No, they need a little bit more time to make their arrangements and.
In addition to the conferences that they're now holding with their representatives and their senators, are you going to send a statement, something like a telegram, something similar to this? I mean, the leadership conference is going to send a statement to each senator?
Well, we have sent messages to senators, and we have also had conferences with them. But more important than that, our constituent organizations back home have sent telegrams from the home states of the senators. The NAACP has had telegrams sent from eight states today. And there will be telegrams from some six more states. In addition to that, we're seeing individual senators and conferring with them. That's going on all day today, and will go on tomorrow up until the vote at 2 o'clock.
I understand that Senator Clark told the group last night that they hadn't been receiving a sufficient amount of mail on this thing, so they didn't know how the people back home were thinking about it, as far as women.
Well, I tell you, the in the matter of the mail, I think the feeling has gotten over to the country that this isn't really a sincere performance here, and that it can't do them any good. And so they don't write about it. It doesn't excite them. It isn't that they're not excited about civil rights. They are. But they've gotten the impression that this is sort of a ring around the rosy business. Between Russell and Johnson and Dirksen, and every day it seems to be confirmed, so they don't write. I don't say they don't write. The senators, and anything under 500 letters, the senator says he isn't getting any mail on this question. No. Yeah.
Mr. Wilkins, Senator Hennings today released his right to vote bill. Have you had a chance to look at that?
No, I haven't. I'm sorry. It was released today?
Yes.
No, I haven't. I haven't seen it. At noon?
At noon, yes.
Yes. Well, at noon.
I think he would have spoken on it except for Senator Newberry's death.
Well, Senator Hennings, of course, has been one of the consistent supporters of civil rights. When I say this has been a ring around the rosy, I've attempted to emphasize the leadership, because we have, of course, many fine supporters of civil rights, and our feeling is directed against this extraordinary situation in which the leadership is fighting.
Have you and your associates been to see Senator Dirksen yesterday or today?
Senator Dirksen was seen yesterday, if I'm not mistaken. And I saw him, or the agents of the various organizations here see him at any time, frequently. And we had Senator Dirksen interviewed by about 20 top leaders, not just the delegates from the states. He's been accessible, but he hasn't been very definitive.
I thought he was easy to pin down.
He's easy to see. Yeah. He's easy to see. You may or may not have seen that article in Harper's called The Wizard of Ooze about Senator Dirksen.
Would you
care
to
comment?
Ooze.
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and every time I ask a lawyer about it, I get a different answer. It depends on the lawyer you ask. But there seems to be general agreement that all the voter proposals can stand improvement, that they have certain weaknesses. And what we would expect would be that the voter registration proposals would be proposal that finally adopted would be the one that was the simplest and addressed itself to the problem in the quickest way. For example, we do not believe that a proposal